This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Dave Pitts is a former senior CIA executive. Before his retirement last fall, Dave served as the assistant director of CIA for South and Central Asia, the agency's top officer for that important region. Dave spent a number of years in Afghanistan, and he served as the chief of CIA's two largest field stations, both with a heavy counterterrorism focus. Dave joins us today to talk about ISIS-K, an increasingly dangerous terrorist group that makes its home in South Asia. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Dave, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
I don't think I've seen you since since our 4 o'clock counterterrorism meetings in the director's conference room. So it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah. So Dave, as you know, we're gonna talk today about ISIS-K, which is the ISIS group that operates out of South Asia. And I actually today want to start with a punchline because there's so many people talking about this. And you know, normally you'd build to the punchline, but let's just start with it. And the punchline is that ISIS-K is one of, if not the most dangerous international terrorist groups in the world, which is why we're going to take an entire podcast and talk about it. Let me just put some data points on the table here. In late December of last year, police in Germany disrupted what they said was an ISIS-K plot to attack a cathedral in Cologne, you know, possibly saving the lives of hundreds. In early January, ISIS-K conducted an attack in Iran, which killed nearly 100 people, injured nearly 300. And as everyone knows, just late last month, ISIS-K conducted, you know, a savage attack at a concert hall in Moscow, killing nearly 140 and injuring over 180. And during this entire time, Dave, as you know better than anybody, they've continued to regularly conduct attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I just wanted to put that data on the table here and ask you what your assessment is of the danger that this group poses.
Yeah. Certainly it's an increasingly dangerous group that has reminded us it has the intent and the capability to conduct terrorist operations across international waters. It has pursued those aspirations for some time now and demonstrated capabilities along the way, as you pointed out, to do that. So those aspirations and those capabilities are very real now. And I always like to think in terms of where we have an intelligence advantage and the fact that we had information on an ISIS plot to conduct attacks that we could share is a good thing for us. Of course, ISIS-K will be looking at protecting any future operations. So it'll be important we continue to pay close attention to every bit of information we get on ISIS planning for the future. But they will do their best to safeguard that.
You know, they've attempted attacks in Western Europe. They've successfully conducted an attack in Moscow. How concerned are you, Dave, that we'll wake up one day and, you know, we'll see an attack in Berlin, Brussels, Paris, etc.?
Yeah, I think we should all be concerned. ISIS-K is a very adaptive organization. It learns from its mistakes. It's patient, and it is undeterred by failure. It's also proven to be an effective recruiter of new talent, talent it needs for certain areas or for certain skills. So we should expect that it has or it is in the process of recruiting now for new external operations. And again, it's going to go to great lengths to protect that from us.
And how do you think, everybody's talking about, you know, the risk to the homeland. How do you think about that threat? How much should we worry? Former CENTCOM Commander General Frank McKinsey, just a couple of weeks ago on ABC's Sunday show, warned about an ISIS attack, you know, right here in the United States. What's your sense of that?
Well, I'm sure that's what ISIS-K wants to do. They've said as much, so we should take that intent seriously. You know, the U.S. is a harder target than Europe for many reasons, but that doesn't mean we're not vulnerable. I mean, ISIS-K has some options. It could recruit individuals from other countries to travel to the United States legally to conduct an attack. That gets back to their ability, their effective capability to recruit. It could attempt to get operatives across the southern border. They expect that's an effective way to get in. It could recruit someone already here, or it could inspire lone wolf attacks in its name inside of the United States. So we have good reason to be concerned and diligent. Let's also remember, going back to Europe, that there are many U.S. embassies with American officials and their families. There's U.S. companies. There's other U.S. interests all over the world. So ISIS-K could view those as more accessible targets as it considers how to conduct an attack in the United States.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you made a very good point about what they have told us they want to do, right? And, you know, as I look back on my career at the agency, I was struck at how often one of our adversaries actually tells us exactly what they're going to do. You know, bin Laden told us he was going to attack us in the United States, right? So we really do need to pay attention to what our adversaries say publicly about what their intentions are.
Agreed.
Yeah. Dave, let's. I really want to dig deep here and understand this group. There's a lot of people talking about ISIS-K, but very few people have really kind of dug deep and tried to understand the organization. And that's what I really want to do here today. I want to really take advantage of, you know, your experience working counterterrorism, your experience working on South Asia, your experience in Afghanistan. So tell me about the observations that you made of ISIS-K when you were in Afghanistan. You know, when and where was the group formed? Where did its first leaders come from? Where did its first operatives come from? You know, and what were they doing before they joined ISIS-K?
Yeah. First, let me say, Michael, there's a lot of excellent analysts in and around Washington who really deep dive on ISIS-K, and I appreciate all the work they're doing. So I, you know, my experience is a little more operational, and I'll just share my own firsthand observations.
Can I just make one point though?
Yeah.
Is in my experience, sitting in my office preparing to go to deputies meetings, is I always had the analysts there and I had the ops people there. And I was struck at how much ground truth and how much excellent insight the ops people provided as I prepared to go to the White House.
Yeah.
So just as background.
Yeah, I agree. I'm saying I appreciate reading what these smart analysts are writing about ISIS-K.
You're a good guy, Dave.
So I was in Afghanistan in late 2012, and there's no ISIS-K, and we weren't talking about ISIS-K. We're talking about Al-Qaeda and stability and a lot of other things. And then we began to see ISIS-K emerge in 2014. You know, it was kind of a crowded space. And so there was some initial thinking that the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, TTP, and others wouldn't let ISIS-K even establish a presence there.
Yeah.
And I think that was really just wishful thinking. You know, ISIS-K had money. It had a solid brand and reputation. And I think its ideology appealed to many of those groups already in Afghanistan. I can remember that Arab members of Al-Qaeda, when they were in Afghanistan, many of them in Afghanistan, they were held in higher esteem by many of the local militants because they thought those Arab members maybe had a pure form or a better understanding of Islam and how to apply it and what they were doing. And so I think ISIS sort of benefited from that same, they were held in higher esteem because of their brand and their reputation. And I think that helped them recruit in that very crowded space they were in. You know, there's a lot of raw materials for ISIS-K to draw on in Afghanistan, skilled extremists from a lot of different groups with, I'd say, skilled extremists from diverse ethnic groups with transactional loyalties. So that was all available for ISIS. And ISIS was small initially, but again, funding, brand, reputation, ideology, available raw materials, it was, you know, established by the time I left there in January 2015. You know, ISIS was made up of some of the TTP and other members who are already there. Maybe there were some disenfranchised Haqqani or Taliban members, probably some IMU and others. So all of these organizations, or maybe some members who weren't happy with their own organizations, were available to join ISIS-K when they were established. I think actually this this sort of set the stage for ISIS-K and how they were recruited later. The idea that they were willing to take, in a reasonable way, anyone from anywhere to join their organization, I think allowed them to recruit faster, maybe faster even than Al-Qaeda could. And unlike Al-Qaeda, which had a primary focus on the West, ISIS-K also focused on the regions, or as they might say, the apostates in the regions. So that included Russia, Iran, China, everyone else. It also actively attacked Shia community. So this much broader and maybe more localized view of the enemy likely increased their popularity and their ability to recruit.
Were they more extreme, or is that how you think about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. They were certainly brutal, but we've seen Al-Qaeda be brutal. We've seen the Taliban be brutal. We've seen a lot of brutality from groups, but they were certainly brutal, and I think single-mindedly in achieving their goals. Some might say that made them more extreme, but I just think it meant they were on a path and they were committed to getting there by whatever means. And in many cases, that made them look more extreme, but certainly made them look more brutal than some of the other groups.
Was that one of the attraction to members of these other groups, that they seemed to be, you know, more willing to do what was ever necessary for the cause?
I think, you know, I might defer to some of the analysts I own that one, Michael. But what I think was, if you're in northern Afghanistan and maybe you're from Central Asia and you really want to go after Russia or you want to go after some other group, ISIS gave you a way to think about that and maybe plan that and do that. So I think, or if you wanted to attack Shia populations wherever they were, ISIS gave you the ability to do that. And I think for many members who were joining, there were just more opportunities to go do things against targets they considered legitimate than maybe if they joined Al-Qaeda and the focus was on, you know, Paris or London or something. A distant legitimate target, as they viewed it.
In terms of targets, did they start by focusing just inside Afghanistan, and then reach outward, or was that always part of what they were doing? Was it always part of the plan? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, for instance, if we go back to Russia, there's always been an intent to go after Russia from ISIS, and it might not have been as clearly articulated initially, but it certainly was more clearly articulated as they went. But it's certainly consistent with how they see themselves as an organization. I think from a practical standpoint, it was easier to conduct operations inside of Afghanistan, and they still can do that, attacking sort of those regional targets. If you wanted to go after a target in Russia, as an example, that would just take longer to do and more planning and more preparation more money. So it was just easier to conduct those operations initially. And by the way, in 2014, in 2014, 2015, when they were established, plenty of international targets, as well as the Taliban, available to them in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Okay. Let's maybe get a little deeper here in terms of membership. And I'm wondering, Dave, how the group has evolved over time in terms of its membership. I recently read something from a think tank that talked about the growing number of guys from Tajikistan who are now part of ISIS-K. Is that new? Is that always been the case? Is the membership evolving, I guess, is what I'm asking.
And you know, Michael, there's a lot of information I don't have access to now in my retired role. I think they've always been effective recruiters in Afghanistan and in North Afghanistan, and that is where the borders are with Central Asia. So I think they had a great opportunity to recruit from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and really all of the Central Asian countries, even those that might not have had a border. And we know from looking back over time, there were a lot of Tajik members in Al-Qaeda. So we know there's a population there along that border. So I think, you know, they've been in the organization all along, but I do think Russia has singled itself out for some additional visibility by ISIS-K. And I think that improves recruitment from Russian-speaking Central Asians. And if you're ISIS-K and you want to conduct an attack on Russia, which they clearly have done and may want to do again, they probably have been recruiting from Russian-speaking Central Asians for some time now.
Yeah. So why has Russia kind of made itself more of a target? What did you mean by that?
Well, look at what Russia has done. So ISIS blames Russia for some of their failures in Syria, and look at what they've done against the Chechens. And so ISIS has plenty of fodder for recruitment to use against recruits against Russia.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So let's talk about counterterrorism operations against the group. You know, you were in Afghanistan. What can you tell us, and perhaps you're limited here in what you can talk about, but what can you tell us about U.S., the rest of the coalition that was with us in Afghanistan, the Afghan government, what we were doing against ISIS-K before our exit from Afghanistan?
Yeah, if I could, let me provide some transitional comments before I come to that.
Sure, so, sure.
You know, in the early days, ISIS-K tried to take and hold territory inside of Afghanistan. So if your ultimate goal is the caliphate, you're going to at some point try to do that. Well, that was hard when everybody was there. So the U.S., the coalition, Afghan forces, and separately, not in a coordinated way, but separately, the Taliban were working against ISIS-K. So it had a hard time controlling territory. It had some territory in Nangarhar province, and it just couldn't hold on to it. There's too much pressure. So ISIS-K made the decision to become more urban-centric, and it moved into Kabul and the areas around Kabul. It moved into Jalalabad. And I actually think this was an important transition for ISIS-K. They became adept at recruiting in the urban areas, particularly college-educated youth and others. They quickly learned to create compartmented cells so they could operate independently in the city and make it very hard for all of us to sort of disrupt that. And they refined urban terrorist techniques. And you might recall in 2020, ISIS-K launched a rocket attack on President Ghani's second inauguration.
Right.
And I remember talking to General Scott Miller once, who was at that ceremony, and he said something to the effect, you know, had those rockets shifted one way or the other to a very small degree and killed a dozen Western diplomats, we'd be having a very different conversation today about ISIS-K. That was back then in 2020.
Yeah.
And they also, they sort of perfected those urban techniques. I mean, you might also recall they conducted several multiple rocket attacks against the international zone in 2020 and 21 using that same technique. They would have a vehicle pull up to a precise place on the road at the right time, and it would then, they would command detonate, and it would initiate multiple rockets being launched from the rear of that vehicle to targets across the international zone. They did that several times with very good effect, and there were a couple of cases where had they not had problems with fuses on those rockets, again, we might be having a different conversation about ISIS because they might have had much greater damage against the international community there in Kabul. And even with all this pressure we were putting on them, they were still resilient and determined. They attacked, you know, maternity ward. They attacked University of Kabul. They tried to take out the vice president. they really continued to refine their urban attack capabilities while they were in Kabul. And so back to your question. You know, there's a lot of pressure being put on ISIS-K by the U.S., the coalition, and ANDSF. Because ISIS-K was in Kabul, there was great concern that they could go after large population targets. They could go after the government. They could go after the international zone. They could go after our own embassy. So we worked on that pretty hard. It was a very well-coordinated effort, the U.S. and the coalition and our ANDSF partners. As I said earlier, they very good at compartmenting their cells inside of Kabul, so it was difficult to root those out, even given all those efforts. And I'm sure quite a number of attacks were disrupted, but some weren't, and some of those were notable. And I would just say, even with all that pressure, ISIS-K was very resilient, very determined in Afghanistan. That's attacking targets, Afghan targets, Taliban targets, and then Western targets when they could.
Yeah. Yeah. What about the Taliban? The Taliban, you know, and ISIS-K are not exactly, you know, they don't see eye to eye. They're basically competing over, you know, competing over who rules Afghanistan. But was the Taliban active against ISIS-K?
Yeah. You know, the Taliban did think at one point in 2015 that ISIS-K might join them. So they made an effort that failed. And so they've essentially been at war, if that's what they might call it, with ISIS-K since then. You know, they view ISIS-K as a threat to their regime and the stability it wants to demonstrate in Afghanistan. But it's also bigger than that. So it is a battle for space. They don't want ISIS-K to have any space in Afghanistan. They don't want ISIS-K to conduct any attacks. But it's also an ideological battle, again, where some groups in Afghanistan thought ISIS-K had a pure form of the ideology. And so the Taliban are working against that as well. ISIS-K likes to say that the Taliban is sort of an ally to the West. That's something the Taliban doesn't really like. So the Taliban is actively working against ISIS-K in Afghanistan. They'll do that with our information or without our information or information to anybody else. They have to. They see it as a matter of survival. I would defer to the analysts, but I expect it would be fair to say they've gotten better at disrupting some local attacks in Afghanistan, although ISIS-K has done those, and you can clearly see those. But I don't think I would say they understand or can disrupt any external operations that ISIS-K might be planning from Afghanistan.
When the U.S. and the coalition were there, was there any cooperation between the Afghan government and the Taliban against ISIS-K, or any cooperation between the coalition and the Taliban and ISIS-K or not?
I don't think there was anything called cooperation between the coalition and the Taliban on ISIS-K. I mean, we were
trying to kill the Taliban, yeah.
Yeah, we were also fighting the Taliban, and we were fighting ISIS-K at the same time. I can't say if there was any cooperation between the Afghan government and the Taliban, but I seriously doubt it.
What happened to the CT mission against ISIS-K after we left? You know, how much pressure came off? What was the impact of that pressure coming off? Talk a little bit about that. It's an important inflection point, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, look, and the IC said it, right, that without a presence, we're going to lose significant collection capability. And it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, we knew that. I mean, certainly you can do some things over the horizon and remotely, but it's not the same. So we lost a significant collection capability against ISIS-K. And then the consistent pressure being applied by the U.S. government and the coalition and ANDSF, which did a lot against ISIS-K, when that was removed, I mean, that was, of course, was a big deal for ISIS-K. That allowed them to grow and expand. When the Taliban took over Kabul, they didn't know Kabul as well as ISIS-K did. ISIS-K was already well entrenched and well connected. So the Taliban really weren't ready to counter ISIS-K when they took over. ISIS-K had already shifted from "we want to hold territory" to "we're going to operate from the urban environments." And they were several steps ahead of the Taliban when the Taliban moved into Kabul.
So it's much less effective, The pressure on ISIS-K, much, you know, certainly from us, right? We're not there anymore. But even from the Taliban, there's been a step down, you would say.
Well, so certainly from us, right? I can't speak to what our collection looks like today. But we know it's significantly reduced because of we're not there now. And so the pressure, you know, back when I think the Taliban gets a lot of credit for taking space away from ISIS, like in Nangarhar. But I think that pressure came from the U.S. and the coalition, ANDSF. Taliban did it separately. So, you know, the Taliban, again, sees this as a matter of survival. They're going to work against ISIS-K. But ISIS-K is a formidable target for them, as we see from the attacks they continue to conduct in Afghanistan and now outside of Afghanistan.
We are talking with former senior CIA operations officer Dave Pitts, and we'll be right back with more of that conversation after a break.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Do they have an operational presence outside of Afghanistan? I read somewhere that they're active inside Pakistan, not just in terms of conducting attacks, but actually, you know, using it as a space to operate, train, etc.
Yeah, I'm sure Pakistan would deny, but just think back to what that safe haven looked like some number of years ago. It was in the Fatah, as we used to say all the time, but we don't talk about the Fatah much anymore, but it was certainly in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And I think the difference now is because the coalition and the U.S. isn't there, they have more space available to them in Afghanistan. And I think certainly there's the potential they can operate from Pakistan. Look, ISIS is a smart organization, so it's not going to put its teams, its forces, its capabilities, its media, its external op planners all in one place. They're going to disperse across the region as much as they can to protect and project those operations.
Yeah. You know, this is a little broader than ISIS-K, but, you know, when I was deputy, I went to Pakistan more than I went to any other country in the world because of the focus on Al-Qaeda, of course. And since we left Afghanistan, I've been struck by how much of a threat groups in Afghanistan are posing to Pakistan, right? ISIS-K, the TTP, right? You know, and this is kind of blowing back on Pakistan, right? Their support for the Taliban, they were hedging, right? Hedging any outcome, and they're paying a price now. They're paying a price to, you know, for the choices they made over the 20 years of the Afghan war. Is that your sense?
Yeah, I think Pakistan was hoping for a different outcome or thinking it would go differently, thinking that their relationship with the Taliban would give them greater control over the Taliban, greater influence over the Taliban, give them secure borders, give them a lot of other things that haven't played out. And so certainly those security risks that are coming from Afghanistan into Pakistan are pretty high and they're pretty significant. And we've seen TTP and others conduct some significant attacks there. So yeah, I think Pakistan now joins the other neighbors, most of the other neighbors, in really worrying about terrorism that crosses their borders from Afghanistan. And not just terrorism, also the potential that ISIS-K recruiters are not just sending terrorists into those countries, but trying to recruit terrorists from within those countries.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to come full circle here for where we started a discussion about, you know, the threat that ISIS-K poses. Where were you, Dave, prior to 9/11?
I was not in the agency. I was in another organization.
Yeah. So I was, of course. And this feels a little to me like deja vu. You know, we've got a group that says it wants to attack us. Its capabilities are clearly growing. It's now conducted, you know, in the last 3 months, two significant attacks outside of Afghanistan. You know, one we could call Europe, Moscow. And, you know, that parallelism with Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11 is worrying to me. And, you know, I'm sure our colleagues who are still, you know, at the agency are focused on this as much as they possibly can. You know, you and I both know that. But I worry about the resources that they have available to, you know, in a world where there's a war in Ukraine, there's a, you know, war in Gaza, yeah. And, you know, and we're focused on the emergence of China, right, as the ultimate competitor. So, you know, I just worry about all that. I don't know if you want to comment or not, but I'm, you know, that just strikes me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, Michael, I think the thing we need to be careful of are pivots, right? I'm not a big fan of this idea of pivoting.
Yeah.
Because I think when we pivot to something, it might mean we're pulling resources and experts and capabilities and infrastructure from other things.
That's what the word means, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's what the word means. And so if you're the target or you're the issue that gets pivoted toward, then you're good. But if you're something else, it means you're losing something. I think we got to, you know, the IC has been accused of that in the past, and maybe those concerns are legitimate. We should just be careful that we're not pivoting away to Russia and China and Iran and North Korea and others, because I actually think as the United States, we have the ability to manage all those things. It just
we
really
sure
requires good priorities and good planning.
We sure do.
And not leaving an issue, ISIS-K or Al-Qaeda, sort of behind us with the idea that that's over and done with, and now let's focus on everything else. We're not the country that'll make that mistake, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so too. Dave, I want to ask you two more questions, and I know, and the first one, I'm just going to start with the caveat. I know you're not a policymaker, and I know you were never a policymaker, but I also know that we had directors of CIA who weren't shy about asking all of us, you know, what we should do about an issue. So that's what I want to ask: is what do you think the U.S. should do now about ISIS-K? And maybe to put it in context for people, we had many meetings with Leon Panetta, right? He would always ask us, so what do you think we should do, right? If Leon Panetta were the director of the agency today, you were back running the South Asia Mission Center, and he asked you that question, what would you say?
The first thing I might say is we should take a look at ISIS as a regional and global problem and not just a problem in Afghanistan. Even then, mm-hmm. I think we should have said that. And that means we should work more closely with the neighbors in the region, particularly the Central Asians, to counter ISIS-K and all of those other local groups that could potentially support or join ISIS. I think that is what I would have said to him then. And then just based on your last comment, Michael, I think I would have just asked him to continue to apply all available resources to make sure we had the means to continue the mission.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we're great at mission, right? We're absolutely great at mission. Put a mission in front of us and, you know, nobody does it better. We're not particularly good at prioritizing, right? Sitting down and saying, okay, what do we need to focus on more? And, you know, Leon did that with AQAP in Yemen and with Al-Shabaab. I remember him calling all you guys up and saying, hey, you know, we got to start focusing on these two groups, not just on Al-Qaeda in South Asia, right? So it's doable, but sometimes we get so focused on the day-to-day fight that we have to tell ourselves, stand back, assess where the threats are, and let's apply the resources in the right place.
Yeah, if I could, I think to me that our goal should be to evolve, not pivot. Not make big changes, but sort of evolve in a very thoughtful, calculated way as how we look at our national security priorities. That's harder because evolving means you're doing things on a more regular basis, but it means you're making subtle changes based on real world events and real threats, to how you use your people, your experts and language and infrastructure and all those sorts of things. It puts a greater demand on us, I think, to do that because it means we're doing this on a regular basis. But I think that's where the solution is instead of waiting until we need to pivot.
Yeah. Yeah. Second question, which I think a lot of people will be interested in what you have to say. Whatever happened to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan? The DNI's recent worldwide threat testimony says that Al-Qaeda is, and I quote here, is at its operational nadir in Afghanistan. You know, do you agree with that? If so, why hasn't Al-Qaeda, you know, bounced back? You know, I testified before Congress as a private citizen that I was deeply concerned about that. If we left Afghanistan, you know, I think I said 18 months to 24 months, didn't happen. You know, what's your sense? What's your sense of where it is today, why it didn't bounce back immediately, and how much we need to continue to worry about it? Let me put it that way.
Yeah. That's a great question. You know, Al-Qaeda is just it's a different organization today. Leadership losses. I mean, most recently, Zawahiri in Afghanistan. Years of constant, almost relentless pressure have had a serious impact on the organization, as the IC assesses. I would just say, though, Al-Qaeda hasn't gone away. It hasn't waved a surrender flag. There's no tombstone to stand over quite yet. I also think it's not important that the IC pivot away from Al-Qaeda just because of that most recent IC assessment. You know, IC hasn't changed its goals and its missions with regards to the West. They just haven't done that. Now, you know, Michael, you might remember this, but I could remember way back the DA would produce this big book of all the Al-Qaeda members. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
It was a
sure.
big book, right?
Sure.
You would get it electronically, but you'd also get it paper form. And it was just a massive book that would land with a thud on your desk. You're going, holy cow, that's the job. Yeah. But over time, that book got much smaller. And I think with U.S. and international real action against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and other places, I mean, a lot of damage done. I mean, I don't know how many leaders were removed, but a lot. So the organization has been definitely in seriously damaged from all that pressure. But, you know, there's some recent reports. I think you might have seen them, one from the UN that talks about a resurgence of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and they talk about some training camps. And then Foreign Policy Magazine also cited this unpublished report. I don't think it's a classified report, the way they made the reference to it, which makes the same case about resurgence. I haven't heard anything from the IC about any of this report, so I assume the IC assessment stands. You know, there's a lot of conflict within the Taliban about Al-Qaeda. They have had a multi-decade, very close relationship. They've lived together, fought together, died together, and many Al-Qaeda members have Taliban families.
Yeah.
They are ideologically aligned still. So this is not some transactional business arrangement that is simple to break. This is much, much deeper. Haib Atullah may very well want to ensure that Al-Qaeda is under control and can't use Afghanistan to train, recruit, and plan for attacks from Afghanistan. Maybe that's what he really wants. But the question is if all Taliban members agree or will comply. And that conflict represents risk for us. So, I haven't seen this report. I'd really love to see it wherever it is out there. But look, I expect there could be some new camps in Afghanistan if maybe the Taliban is trying to consolidate members of Al-Qaeda who are still in Afghanistan. I think they like to say they're former members, but I'm not sure there is any such thing as a former member. You know, if we have a threat from Al-Qaeda today, there's a real threat from Al-Qaeda. I don't think it's going to come from a training camp in Afghanistan. You know, Al-Qaeda was always very good about compartmenting its external operations. I just recall back in the day, that was the part of Al-Qaeda we knew the least about. We didn't.
Right, right.
We might know more about senior leaders and what they were doing. We would know a little bit about media, but we knew the least about their external operations. So if there's a threat coming from Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, it could be, maybe it's in Afghanistan, but it could be outside of the region somewhere where a small group or compartmented and they're training, they're looking at targets, maybe they're looking at documentation of travel and all sorts of things. So I don't know if those camps themselves, I don't know what those camps represent, if there are there. I expect maybe by now the IC has characterized those and we understand them better.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're raising a really interesting point that, you know, I used to remind my analysts of, which is be really careful just making an assessment off the data you have.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what you don't know, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, to your point about, you know, the compartmentation of the external ops guys, which we may not be seeing, right? You know, I always used to say to the analysts, can you imagine getting, you know, a single intelligence report tomorrow that would change your view completely? And if they can imagine that, then I would say, you know, maybe you shouldn't be so confident about your judgment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, you know, my own view is I haven't seen any reports. I don't have access to anything about what might be going on there now, at least not whatever I have is in the public domain. But we should be watching Afghanistan very closely. As I mentioned previously, there's a lot of raw materials and expertise for terrorism in Afghanistan. One former Afghan official I knew referred to that as the ecosystem of terrorism, you know, which would provide fuel and raw materials for terrorist groups. So Al-Qaeda can still draw on that. And if you think about this, Al-Qaeda has endured incredible hardship over the years. I mean, incredible hardship. So we should absolutely expect it will now try to take advantage of a more hospitable Afghanistan. Our challenge, Michael, is we're experiencing a knowledge gap on some of the issues related to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and that should make us both uncomfortable and diligent.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to leave this, Dave. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us today.
My pleasure, Michael.
That was former CIA officer Dave Pitts. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.